This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories this hour. The annual Hajj pilgrimage is nearing its end in the holy city of Mecca, and Muslims around the world celebrate Eid al-Adha. Iran's president tells his Syrian counterpart that Islamic Republic supports establishment and peace and stability in Syria and opposes any foreign intervention in the Arab country. Sri Lankan protesters refuse to leave President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence, saying they won't give up until he actually steps down. Thank you for joining us. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims are performing the final rituals of the Hajj pilgrimage in the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. One of these rituals is tawaf, or walking in the procession around the Kaaba seven times. Kaaba is the direction Muslims always face while praying. Another ritual is the stoning of the devil, in which pilgrims throw pebbles at rocks symbolizing the Satan. The rituals culminate in Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. On this day, animals are sacrificed to commemorate Prophet Abraham's decision to sacrifice his son in the name of God Almighty. Another essential part of the Hajj pilgrimage is the shaving of the head for men. Women only cut the tips of their hair. Eid al-Adha is celebrated in Muslim countries around the world. The date varies by one day in different countries depending on lunar sightings. Iranians are marking the occasion today. We've reached out to the creative director of Islamic Pulse, Muzaffer Haydar, to ask him about the meaning behind the Hajj rituals and Eid al-Adha. Here is his take.
Eid al-Adha is that, precisely. It is a symbol of Muslim unity across the world, and in many ways it shows the strength of the Muslims globally. It shows that Muslims have the ability to distance themselves, as Imam Khomeini has just recently spoken about, the Western culture, which is infiltrated into the Muslim households even. And what's happening is, throughout the past few years, indeed you could even argue for the past few centuries, is an invasion by Western cultures. And what the efforts of the enemies of Islam have been, whether in the East or the West, is to divide and rule the Muslim lands, to attack the Muslims spiritually, mentally, and politically. Hajj is a reaffirmation of the strength of the Muslims to avert any kind of hostilities from the outside world. This is the revolutionary approach. This is where Imam Khomeini says that when we go to Hajj, we should actually disassociate ourselves and reject the taghuti, or the tyrannical governments that exist in the world. Mm-hmm. These are, for the most part, elements of the Hajj, which are often overlooked. Many people, unfortunately, try to limit the Hajj and Eid al-Adha to just spirituality. But one of the most important points that we have to recognize is that every part of a human being's life, to a lesser or greater extent, is going to be affected by those who rule over us. And so what Eid al-Adha does, and subsequently what Eid al-Ghadir does coming up, is realign the focus. It makes us focus once again on the taghut and on the evil governments of the world.
Iran's president once again pledges continued support for the anti-Israeli resistance front, particularly Syria. Ebrahim Raisi says Iran is for peace and stability and against any foreign intervention in Syria. In a phone call with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Raisi congratulated the Syrian government and the nation on the occasion of Eid al-Adha. The Iranian president hailed the recent visit to Tehran by President Assad and the good agreements that were reached between the two sides. Raisi called for efforts to follow through and implement the deals. Assad also noted that the enemies of the resistance front are growing weaker by the day. He said Iran and Syria are brothers in arms and wished the two nations increasing success at home and abroad. Iran says it has enriched uranium to a purity of 20% using a cascade of advanced centrifuges it launched 2 weeks ago. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Agency of Iran says this was the final technical stage in the process. He said Iran had in advance informed the UN Nuclear Agency of its plan to inject uranium gas into a cluster of IR-6 centrifuges at the Fordo facility. According to Behrouz Kamalvandi, the Western media started hyping up the issue as soon as the International Atomic Energy Agency verified Iran's enrichment. On Saturday, Reuters cited an IAEA report which confirmed Iran has increased enrichment using advanced machines. The news agency once again highlighted Western concerns about Iran's nuclear program, despite acknowledging that Iran had indeed informed the agency of its enrichment plan. Tehran says the Western tactics are only meant to pressure it at the ongoing talks for the removal of sanctions. U.S. President Joe Biden defends his decision to visit Saudi Arabia and meet its crown prince, despite criticism that he's abandoning his stated concerns about the kingdom's human rights records. Biden has written in an opinion piece for the Washington Post that his upcoming visit aims to strengthen a strategic partnership with Riyadh. Biden says the U.S. will use Saudi Arabia's vital energy resources to mitigate the impact of the war in Ukraine on global supplies. That's amid surging fuel costs and inflation at home. But visit goes against Biden's repeated pledges to make Saudi Arabia pay for the killing and dismemberment of dissident journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. Biden's administration has released intelligence findings showing Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman masterminded Khashoggi's murder.
After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperations between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity.
The US government has been under fire for supporting Israeli and Saudi leaders and its weak response to human rights violations, from crimes committed against the Palestinians to the case of Shirin Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi. And now Joe Biden seems to be ignoring the crimes to compensate for his administration's wrong economic policies.
Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline. And he turned the United States from an oil exporting country into an oil importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
Protesters in Sri Lanka say they are not leaving the presidential palace in the capital Colombo until the president actually steps down. People are still milling outside the residence a day after storming it in anger. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and the prime minister have fled with the navy. They say they will resign on Wednesday. Despite that, the chaos is far from over. The South Asian nation is facing chronic food and fuel shortages and a galloping inflation, factors that brought the once relatively rich economy to its knees. Details of a transition of power and the shape-up of the next government are still not clear. We've spoken to Chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace Council, Jahan Pereira. As somebody who has personally taken part in street rallies in Colombo, he talks about what it is that the Sri Lankan people are actually demanding.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time, that as you would have seen footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim, they are touring it. Hopefully they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful that, now there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. the president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
Russia says its forces have struck two Ukrainian army hangars storing U.S.-made artillery weapons. The Russian Defense Ministry says the cache of howitzers was targeted in the eastern region of Donetsk. The United States and its allies have been supplying weapons and military equipment to Ukraine since the beginning of the war with Russia. Moscow has repeatedly warned against such shipments, saying that they prolong the conflict. Also in eastern Ukraine, which is the main theater of war, local emergency services said they had recovered 15 bodies after a Russian missile strike hit a residential area. Rescuers say five people were pulled out of the rubble and that they were in contact with three others under the debris. Moscow has previously dismissed allegations of targeting civilian areas. Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements relating to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital, Brussels.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland.
The political developments do not change our position on the protocol or the way in which we work with our British counterparts on Northern Ireland. Our position is that we should endeavour to seek solutions on the implementation of the protocol, and that's it.
The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic.
The new Prime Minister will carry on more or less the same policy as Boris Johnson, with one difference that maybe he would be a bit more honest with the British citizen.
Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Japan, polling stations for parliamentary elections closed a short while ago, while the whole process was overshadowed by the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party already enjoys a solid majority of seats. Initial reports show the party is gaining from sympathy votes. There has been a surge of support for the Liberal Democrats in the wake of Abe's assassination. The popular former prime minister was assassinated during a campaign speech in support of a local candidate on July the 8th. The suspect, now in custody, has told investigators he targeted Abe because he believed the politician was linked to an unnamed organization. Well, that's it from us in this news broadcast. Stay tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
هيهات أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيت أو تبعد من أدنيت أو تشرد من آويت أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته ورحمت
Brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the Kumail supplication. Hayhat, anta akramu min an tudayya man rabbayta. Far be it from you. You're more generous than torturing him whom you have nurtured. Aw tub'ida man adnayta. To banish him whom you have brought up. Aw tushajjida man awayta. You are far away from driving away him whom you have given an abode. Aw tusallima ila al-bala. مَنْ كَفَيْتَهُ وَرَحِمْتَهُ Or submit to tribulation him whom you have spared and shown mercy. The mercy and blessings of the Almighty Allah have been showering upon the servants. And this reveals Allah's love for His servants. These are the signs of His love for the servants so that the servants might love Him. But the point is that these bounties, these blessings showered up upon the heedful and intelligent hearts are only effective in getting closer to the Almighty Allah. And Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us that supplication is among the keys of Allah's mercy. That is why he, the Exalted, says, "Udu'uni astajib lakum." Call me and I will answer you. And in fact, this is how the servants should try to attract the mercy of Allah. That it seems impossible to do this by any other means. But the point is that one should be sincere in love. And this is how love manifests itself in joining your beloved. Disjoining yourself from all other than the Almighty Allah and joining with Allah and those whom He subhanahu wa ta'ala loves and has commanded to love. These are two sides of one issue.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity, and despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity. No, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, God, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Hayhat, anta akramu min an tudayya man rabbayta. You're more generous than torturing him whom you have nurtured, the one whom you have loved. Just ponder over these three means by which Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam is seeking recourse to Allah. Imam alayhi salam says, "Your good pleasure is my wish, vision of you is my need. With you lies the remedy of my illness, the cure for my burning thirst, and the coolness of my ardor, the removal of my distress." Imam Zainul Abidin is teaching us the means of neediness and indigence that I assume we have discussed in a couple of programs earlier. Imam alayhi salam continues, talking about the most important thing this program is all about, the concept of supplication, the means of supplication. Imam says, "Your neighboring is my request. Nearness to you is the utmost object of my asking. Be my intimate in my loneliness, the releaser of my stumble, the forgiver of my slip, the acceptor of my repentance, the responder to my supplication, and the one who frees me from my neediness." Imam says that I know I am needy, I am indigent, but I have brought my indigence to you. Imam continues, "You are my object, none other. To you alone belongs my waking and my sleeplessness. Meeting you is the gladness of my eye, joining you the wish of my soul. Toward you is my yearning, in love for you my passionate longing, in inclining toward you my fervent craving." And this is the means of love Imam alayhi salam mentions. One of the beautiful pieces of this supplication is this part, that as a prayer has a beauty just like that of art and literature. Imam alayhi salam says, "For my aspiration has been cut off from everything but you." My desire has turned toward you alone. You are my object, none other. This is what true love brings about. This inqita, or somehow cut off, involves in meaning what attachment does not. This is why Imam alayhi salam does not say, my aspiration has been attached to none but you. But he says, my aspiration has been cut off from everything but you. Because the concept of cut off entails both a positive and negative meaning. The meaning of inqita is detachment from the creatures and turning toward Allah. Detachment from the creatures is the negative significance, but the positive significance intended by Imam alayhi salam is that turning toward Allah. This sincerity is love, is what brings about أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيت. Allah is more generous than torturing him whom he has nurtured. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you throughout my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
In the limelight.
Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Waxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading Censoring Palestine. Swarms of Israeli regime bots are crippling pro-Palestinian Twitter accounts. Here's more. On April 29th, Ines Abdulrazak woke up to 80 new Twitter followers. These accounts were following the exact same people that were tweeting about Palestine, but from France or Francophone accounts that work on Palestine, Razak said for her new followers. The advocacy director of Rabbit, the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy's digital platform, became wary of the issue after Abir Khateb, a grants manager at Open Society Foundations, reported mass followings as well. Razak told Min Press News that she began individually reporting each account as fake, but kept her own account open, lest she let the alleged bots win. But after a few days, Razak made her profile private. At the peak of the mass following, Razak had accumulated 400 fake followers. From the end of April through the first few weeks of May, more than 40 pro-Palestine Twitter accounts reported mass followings. Digital rights experts say acquiring huge amounts of fake followers triggers Twitter's algorithm and can lead to the tech giant suspending an account, effectively censoring users by forcing them to make their accounts private. We'll be right back. These accounts included those belonging to human rights, activist organizations, Adala, Combatants for Peace, Breaking the Silence, and Al Mizan Center for Human Rights. They also included news publications and journalists like the Palestine Chronicle, Ali Abu Nima and Hend al-Iryani, and politicians such as Hossam Zumlot, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. Twitter did not respond to main press inquiries on the source of suspicious accounts. Dr. Mark Owen Jones, an assistant professor at Hamad Ben Khalifa University, conducted an analysis that found more than 1,150 fake accounts. Twitter deleted approximately 1,090 of these accounts, according to Jones. His analysis determined that the average account creation time was one of the three per minute, suggesting these accounts were created using an automated process. The profiles were in various languages, including French, Spanish, English, and German, but usually had Arabic bias. They often had strange names like Nobel Betty Thomas and zero followers. They had clearly made up names. Sarah Lee Whitson, who also experienced a large influx of new followers, told Min Press. The vast majority of them had Israeli names and Israeli addresses. Some of them had made up Arab names, which were mangled. It's clear that they are using stolen images of people. In response to the bulk following, software developer Daniel Isterman created a free script to automatically report and block hundreds of these bots for users. Isterman said the spamming problem has a censorship effect by forcing users to make their accounts private. This means they won't be able to distribute their messages widely as they would normally, Isterman told Min Press News. Another area of particular concern is how a flood of fake followers may cause Twitter to shut down an account. When you see such a dramatic increase in followers, it's usually somebody manipulating the system for commercial gain, Isterman said, adding so that could trigger Twitter to automatically flag that as suspicious activity and suspend the activist account. Using Twitter to target human rights defenders and journalists isn't unusual. In 2017, journalist Lona Craig and others who report on Yemen were spammed with thousands of fake followers. Many speculated the culprits were state entities belonging to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The reason behind this particular mass following campaign remains unknown. Jones hypothesized it's acting as a form of social media suppression, writing on Twitter. Some suggest it's a means to degrade the algorithmic quality of a Twitter account so that it possibly gets suspended. Some suggest it's others trying to boost popularity of an account. When it's unsolicited, as in this case, I tend to think it's more of a targeting operation. I'm naturally cynical, but most people who get a sudden influx of fake followers feel unnerved and uncomfortable. If that fact is widely known, it functions as a tool of surveillance and potentially intimidation, that is, you are being watched. It also makes many people mute their accounts for a bit, which has a censorship effect. Razek Whitson and others told Min Press News that the flood of fake followers appears to be diminishing for them. However, a new operation has emerged. In the past week, Jones found around 2,800 fake accounts following pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist accounts who have recently been tweeting on the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh by the Zionist regime. This network is likely the same as one found at the end of April, although now it is active, Jones wrote on Twitter. The accounts have been 0 to 20 followers, with the majority of bias written in English and simply stating the account location, which is the occupied territories. Most accounts don't have a banner picture, and the profile pictures have reportedly been swiped from real people. According to Jones, the accounts have begun liking and retweeting posts without any real partisan regularity. They like both pro- and anti-Palestinian subject matter and follow both pro-Zionist and pro-Palestinian accounts, but appear to target the pro-Palestinian side more. Accounts targeted include the Jerusalem Post, activist organization Jewish Voice for Peace, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, Israeli journalist Ilan Papp, and former Palestinian Liberation Organization Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. Again, the reason for the bulk followers remains unclear. Those who get followed understandably find it intimidating, as if a form of surveillance, to a technique to try and degrade the quality of an account with low-quality follows, Jones wrote on Twitter. The fact remains these are clearly fake accounts and ruin the experience of Twitter. Palestinian digital rights experts have long decried the increasing censorship of Palestinian content online. During the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza and upticks in Israeli regime attacks at Al-Aqsa compound and in Sheikh Jarrah in May 2021, Palestinian activists reported social media companies were removing their content on the Israeli regime violence and ethnic cleansing for violating community guidelines. The social media censorship didn't stop when tensions died down over the summer, though. Last month, social media users in Jordan said their posts related to Israeli regime violence at Al-Aqsa were taken down and their accounts blocked. Additionally, accounts belonging to Palestinian news publications covering the violence in East Al-Quds and at Al-Aqsa were deactivated by Facebook. In their recent monthly report on social media violations, Palestinian NGO Sada Social stated the deletion of Palestinian content is in line with and in response to Israeli requests to tighten the screws on Palestinians and their media. Razek suggested the swarm of fake followers on Twitter may be an extension of Instagram's shadow banning. While the identities behind the fake followers haven't been revealed, many have pointed to the fabricated regime of Israel. The regime of Israel targeting of Palestinian digital content is well documented. According to Hamla, the Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, the Israeli regime Ministry of Justice Cyber Unit sends content removal requests aimed at Palestinian content to social media companies such as Facebook, Google, and YouTube. The Justice Ministry has boasted these corporations comply with 95% of the request. And the Zionist regime organizations and NGOs also encourage their citizens to flag Palestinian content for removal. Tech billionaire Elon Musk's pending purchase of Twitter came with a promise of securing free speech on the digital platform. Free speech is the bedrock of a functioning democracy, and Twitter is the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, the self-declared free speech advocate said in a statement about his Twitter deal. While digital rights experts like Jones are wary of Musk's potential Twitter takeover, Whitson, who has experienced targeted attacks, harassment, and censorship threats for decades for speaking out against the Zionist regime's abuses, views this buyout positively. Whitson doesn't agree the bots are a form of censorship, but she does see them as an assault on free speech. She said it's a form of targeted harassment and bullying. It's a targeted attack on people who are speaking freely, including journalists and human rights activists.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very significant and important question. And that question is this: what is the meaning of the word Allah? As you can see, this question is very important, it's very significant, and it's very central to the value and the importance of the acts of worship that we perform. If we don't know the meaning of the word Allah, what it means, then when we pray, when we ask Allah, and we call on Him using this word, how can that act of worship, how can that prayer, how can that dua have any significance? Right? We, as you know, the value of any act of worship, regardless of whether that act of worship is obligatory or recommended, it's an act of worship of God towards God. Like, for example, it's the prayer, ritual prayer. Or even it could be the salutation that we are sending to one of the immaculate and infallible beings, such as Aima alayhi salam or the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam. And so we don't have a knowledge of, you know, the being that we're addressing, and at a certain level, even the meaning of the names of these beings that we're addressing, right? That act of worship, obviously, the value of it will be all the more less. And conversely, if we have a knowledge of the being we're addressing, right, we know who we're addressing, the meaning of the words that we're expressing, right, obviously that act of worship, you know, it has significance. Now, we don't want to somehow imply that if there's a person and he really calls on Allah from the depths of his heart, even if he doesn't know the meanings of the words of the prayers that he's using to address Allah, right, it's that prayer doesn't have the ability to ascend towards God and it won't be answered. No, we're not trying to say that in any way. Obviously, a prayer that emits from the heart, right, it comes out from the heart, right? Really comes out from the heart, from the depths of the fitrat and the nature, right, there's no doubt in the fact that that will be accepted. But obviously, knowing the meanings of these words, knowing the significance of the being we are addressing and who we are addressing, obviously this helps in activating that prayer, that it comes out from the heart. And that's why this is significant. Fortunately, this question has been answered by our a'imma alayhi salam themselves, right? So we have various hadiths which have addressed this question and answered this question. Today, let's look at a hadith which has been narrated from Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has been reported to have said, Allah means the one who is worshipped and whom people are too bewildered to comprehend his essence and fathom his identity. This is kind of paradoxical. On one hand, right, we're trying to address the question of what Allah means. On the other hand, in response to this question, we're saying Allah means the being who is not comprehended. Right? It's almost paradoxical. Right? But, it's been narrated that Ibn Sina, the famous scholar, was once reported to have said towards the end of his life, he said that after all of my studies and investigations and everything that I conducted and researched with respect to God, in the end, finally, I reached the conclusion that I don't know anything about God. But this kind of knowledge and this kind of admittance to ignorance, which comes after investigation, right, is far more significant than the ignorance that we have before that, right? So it is a type of knowledge, and this is, in fact, the highest form of knowledge that we can have of God. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meaning of Allah, and till next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.